Welcome to the Journey to Multifamily Millions podcast. Start your journey today of building wealth through multifamily real estate investing. Listen to inspiring conversations with experts in the field from every step of the process. It doesn't matter if you're new to multifamily real estate or if you're already the savvy pro, we cover it all. And now your host, founder and CEO of Zana Investments, Tim Little.
All right, everyone. Andrew Rosenberg is a passive investor in real estate who lives in Hawaii with his wife, son, and three dogs. He comes from a long line of entrepreneurs and earned his master's in accounting before going to work for the family business where he's been for 20 years. His journey to multifamily millions started with investing in duplexes and single-family homes after the financial crisis. 2 years ago, he realized it wasn't scaling and it had stopped being fun, so he transitioned to passively investing in syndications. Today, he has invested in 23 syndications as a limited partner, totaling over 3,400 units. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Wow, wonderful, Tim. Really excited. Thank you for having me.
Great. So I gave everyone a high-level overview of your background, but on this show, we really try to focus on your journey in multifamily real estate. So please talk a little bit about how you got started in real estate and then multifamily more specifically.
Oh, okay, sure. You know, like most people, I started on BiggerPockets reading article posts and frankly being very frustrated. I didn't find a lot of good content or frankly didn't really meet a lot of the right people. And then I stumbled onto Lane Kawaoka from Simple Passive Cash Flow, and he's from Hawaii and we're close enough in age that there was a higher level of comfort. So we kind of started chatting and I had to get over the mindset shift of control. You know, owning your own real estate portfolio, that's one thing. But, you know, passively giving somebody money and them running everything, that was a stretch. And then the liquidity of, you know, 3 to 5 years or more. So my very first deal was a minimum deal on a very, very vanilla, straightforward value add play in a relatively stable market with pref equity where you're on the higher than the equity side below the debt structure on the capital stack, but you're capped at a certain rate. And that certain rate was still higher than I was frankly getting from my own portfolio. So I did that. And once you start seeing the distributions coming in, it was like, okay, this isn't crazy. I can stomach it emotionally more. And then I started investing a little more. And, you know, I realized, wait, I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm really just trusting Lane or, you know, trusting sponsors, I got to get more knowledge. So then, you know, the next phase was consuming a lot of YouTube videos or podcasts. And you top out pretty quickly on that as well. So Bronson Hill, who's been a very good friend of me, he has very much been encouraging me, saying, Andy, you know what, you got to get out of your shell. I know you're a lone wolf or an introvert, but go do some networking. And I said, Bronson, I'm out in Hawaii. I don't fly. He says, don't worry, there's these Zoom meetings, you know, try them out. So I tried one Zoom meeting out and I had a blast. I was so shocked. I had no idea it could be that fun. No idea people would be that interesting and that people would be that willing to share information. So, you know, flash forward to now, you know, Monday morning, I'm with Angel Williams's group. On Tuesday, I'm with Isaac Weinberg's group. Wednesday, I'm with George Roberts' group. I leave Thursday open to meet with people generally. And then Friday, I have Brian Briscoe's Tribe of Titans. So, you know, that's 4 days a week of network meetups. And I got to tell you, it was the best thing I've ever done. So much fun.
Yeah, and that's such a great way to learn, too. I mean, especially once the pandemic hit, and it's not like there was any in-person meetups, but you're obviously geographically isolated anyways from where a lot of those meetups are happening. So it sounds like those Zoom meetings, you know, it was kind of perfect timing in the sense that everyone was kind of forced to bring those onto the online platform, which gave an opportunity for people like you to get involved in those groups. I guess one question I would ask is, have you always been passively investing, or did you, I think you said you own some single family and some duplexes.
Yeah.
First, did you own those exclusively or were you a limited partner even throughout that period?
Oh, okay. For that period, it was always just my own entities. Yeah. So, you know, being out of state in Hawaii, it was always, you know, with a property manager. But you know, as you know, there's no real passive. You're still managing the property manager. And once you get up to too many properties, all they have to do is have one problem a year, and you have 12 properties, you'd have a problem every month and it stops being fun. And you know, the phone call about the radiator's broken or the furnace or the air conditioner or the roof needs patching or whatever, that shouldn't discourage an investor. But my personal view is everyone should own a single family or a duplex. It is a mindset shift that I do see missing in LPs, those that have and haven't. But then at the same point, it's like, it's something you do, you get started with, and you move on. It's a stepping stone. To me, the mistake I made was I continued down the path far too long. I should have sooner gone to the multifamily route. So that's a mistake I made, but you know, it was a profitable mistake. It wasn't the end of the world. I did learn, but the learning slowed down dramatically once you get past your third or fourth house. You're not really learning anything new at that point. So that for me was the big mistake that I personally made. So it should have been a stepping stone.
Yeah. I mean, and you're lucky that, you know, so-called mistake, you know, didn't cost you money.
No.
It's just that regret of, you know, wishing you could do something sooner. And I can certainly identify with that. I went kind of the same route. You know, I knew I wanted to invest in real estate, and I was one of those people who jumped directly to multifamily, but small multifamily, because I had been an accidental landlord before, you know, had my primary residence and had to rent it out because of situations, but that wasn't an intentional investment, right? Mm-hmm. So then my first intentional investment was a duplex, and I decided, hey, this is the best of both worlds. You know, I have this property that I was able to afford, but I'm mitigating the risk because even if one side is not leased up, the other side is. So I'm always able to make the mortgage. And then from there, went to a triplex. But I started to run into the same issues that you're talking about. And I thought it would be better if I was managing it myself, because then I was saving that 10% and, you know, all that. But it was not. Then it became more of my time versus the money. Mm-hmm. And I wound up investing so much more time into self-managing that it began to detract from my efforts to do the multifamily syndication side of things. And that's when I transitioned away and said, you know what, I think I'm done with this small multifamily, you know, managing myself. That's some great insight. And I think a lot of investors run into that same situation, you know, whether retired or whether they just don't have the time or desire to deal with those problems that come up on the single family side, they tend to move over. I guess I would ask about your first deal that you did as a passive investor. Were you nervous about that, or had you kind of educated yourself enough on the topic that you felt confident in your assessment of that deal?
I wouldn't say nervous, but it still was a major mindset shift for me to give up control. Giving up control was still just really a tough thing that time. I mean, now it's pretty easy, frankly, but that first time was a stretch. I watched I think it was like 45-minute or hour-long, you know, presentation. You know, I'd done quite a bit of reading, and I said, look, if you're going to put your money where your mouth is, you're complaining to your family members that portfolio is making you miserable, it's not making you happy. This is the next logical step. Just man up and do it. So we manned up and did it. And then I was like, okay, that wasn't so bad. And then, you know, you get the monthly reports coming in, and they sealed the driveway or put up the new monument sign to attract tenants. And, you know, here's the occupancy. And we got a couple of units that we've vacated out, and we're renovating them up, and we're going to get a higher rent. And you're saying, okay, all the stuff that was talked in the business plan is happening. Boom, boom, boom. You know, and you know, sometimes you'll get one, hey, rent roll was a little light this month, so we pushed off the pool deck, you know, renovation to next month. But it happens. And then you're like, okay, I trust these guys. They, you know, when things don't go perfect to the spreadsheet, you know, they tell you, and I can deal with that. You can, that life is not an Excel spreadsheet. That's why I like that people should own at least one single family prior to multifamily investing as a syndicator, because you have a better appreciation that life just doesn't happen in an orderly fashion. And, you know, things like vacancies, you're going to have firsthand experience, and you're going to also just understand like how important a property manager is. You know, like to me, if a dentist who's never really invested in real estate invests in a deal with you, let's just say, and it's 300 units in Arizona. And another guy who's had 2 or 3 duplexes, sold them, was tired of it, invests with you in Arizona. The guy that's going to ask you a lot of questions about, well, who's this property manager? Why this property manager? That's going to be the guy that's owned the properties, because he knows very well that the property is great. That's an asset. But if you don't run it right, it doesn't work. And it's a huge difference of understanding between people who have and who haven't owned a rental property, the appreciation for the asset management side. And it's something in spread, in the pitch decks that I often see is it's given very short detail or even skipped over completely. It's almost like, we'll just plug in a property manager because don't worry, it's a big enough property. There's a big company. That's not really a good answer. And it's really missing an opportunity for a great hook, because I've met people and they've just kind of said, here's our property manager. Why? And they tell me, there's 5 properties within a square mile of each other and they're the manager for all of them. We're going to get a good rate and they know what they're doing. Our property is right within that square mile that has, these 5 properties. Then I'm like, well, why didn't you tell me that in the presentation? That's a great hook. Why wouldn't you tell me this? I don't know. It's just funny, the formulaic pitch deck that seems to go around. I guess everybody took the same weekend, a course in pitch deck, or they're hiring the same pitch deck company. I see the same pitch deck over and over and over again. And then when I ask them a question, sometimes I get a great answer. And I'm like, why wasn't that in your presentation? I didn't need 19 minutes of the MSA. We all know Houston's hot or Phoenix is hot, but having slide after slide with these are the employers and these are the metrics and this is why the city's hot and it's on this top 10 list and U.S. New World's top 10 list. We all know that. You had to be living under a rock the last 10 years not to know, Phoenix or Houston was hot.
Yeah, no, you bring up some really great points. And I think it's funny because I look at pitch decks too, obviously. And I think the same thing, like, I don't need 10 pages on why this city is growing or good, especially when you can say it in 2 pages, because at that point I feel like it's just superfluous. You're just wasting time. Oh, they're doing this $1 billion project in this district and that $1 billion project in that district, and these are the top. I get it, and you're right, that time would be much better spent talking about the core members of the team that's going to keep that deal on track, which is whoever you have as your general contractor or your property management team, who is the prime, because a lot of times they're overseeing the renovations as well in many instances. So that, and I will agree with you also that having self-managed, I have my empathy for property managers has grown leaps and bounds ever since that time. A unique appreciation for the things that they have to deal with, whether it be tenants or just random weird stuff that pops up.
Yeah. My only clarification would be like the submarket. If we're talking about one neighborhood or others where, this particular neighborhood is really on the up and coming, or there's something specific to that submarket, for that neighborhood, then give me slides, sure. But like the big, metro area, I don't need a slide on necessarily if it's, Phoenix or Miami or, some hot market, right? Austin.
Yeah, exactly. I think I need a lot more convincing if it's a tertiary market, like a town I've never heard of.
Yeah. Then by all means. Yeah. I mean, if you're dealing with a state that people have a bias against or a general apathy or ignorance of, then sure, by all means, convince me that there's enough growth in that market that it's not to be shunned. That makes sense. But yeah, most people are chasing all the hot markets, and, drone photos and pretty pictures of cabanas by poolsides, that's all lovely and good, but that doesn't tell me anything about whether we're going to make money. We're here to make money. We're not here to give the wife or the spouse, your husband or your partner or your parents a pretty brochure and say, look how pretty this building I invested in. We want to know that you bought it at a good price. We're going to improve the building, raise the rents and cut costs, and we're going to sell or refinance in 3 to 5 years. I'm not interested. It doesn't help my ego how pretty the building is now or will be. That doesn't interest me at all.
Yeah. And so you've done a lot of these deals. You've done 23 deals. So that brings a very unique perspective, because you're almost like a professional passive investor at that point.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, you know, what methods, processes do you have for vetting sponsors and deals? And, you know, what questions do you always ask them?
You know, a lot of it depends too on what's in the presentation, because a lot of times the question, you know, would get covered. But like for me right now, the single biggest issue outside of the property management we discussed, you know, for me now, the holdup is on financing. You know, because there's so much uncertainty in capital markets, we just don't know what's going to happen. There's enough risk in all these projects. You know, we have jurisdictional risk, we have operational risk. God forbid, one of the main GP gets hit by a car tomorrow. I know we got all kinds of risks that we're going to deal with. I'd like to eliminate interest rate risk as much as possible. Now, when I say that, people sometimes mislead, you know, misunderstand. Like, I'm not saying there's not a credit risk in terms of, God forbid we hit the GFC again and lending dries up and even worthy lender, you know, lendees don't get money. I just mean in terms of interest rates spiking. So when I'm looking at deals, what I'd like to see is, you know, you've got the rate fixed with a local bank and you found yourself a good rate because you've done multiple deals in that area that have gone full cycle and a local banker trusts you. That was one, that's kind of the synopsis of one deal I did recently. Another one was, it was a very heavy value add play at a very good price. So they bought the rate cap. The deal had enough meat on the bones, they could buy the rate cap. If you can't buy the rate cap, it implies to me your deal is too skinny. We don't need a skinny deal. There's so many deals out there, I don't have to chase a deal. So to me, why would I chase a skinny deal? If your project can't pencil with a rate cap, and I get that the rate caps are just shooting up, so that's a tough thing, but why should I as an investor take on yet another element of risk? And then one presentation that I really liked, it was a tertiary market, and they started off their presentation, bam, first thing was the debt structure. And I liked that they did that. And to him, when pressed, yeah, geez, that's a little odd. You're not following the formula. It was on a webinar. You know, someone had just asked him. It wasn't a criticism. It was just, wow, that's different. And the guy's like, well, you know, everybody's out there with a fancy city and a big IRR. But what separates all these deals? The unique thing about our deal is the debt structure. So why not start off with the hook? You know, it's a pitch deck. Well, I call it a hook deck, frankly. But, it's, you know, what's the hook? And for him, it was, we found a building very badly managed, so we can run it better. We have a track record of running it better. They answered the property management question, but the big deal was that building had a 10-year fixed rate loan at 4.35. So for them, it was, there's this margin of safety if we've got 7 years to turn this building around and make all the physical improvements, you know, kick out the riffraff, get the better tenants in, start bumping up rent. So for me, there was like, interest rate risk isn't going to kill this deal. All he has to do now is really, or his team, is execute the business plan. Then he went into the business plan, went into the track record of how he's done it in the past, you know, and going into who the key players that are that do the different elements of the plan. And it was the best presentation I've ever, it's probably the best presentation I've ever seen. And I was like, okay, see, this is how presentations should be handled, is you should be starting off with the hook. What's the hook? What is unique about your deal? I'm no marketing expert, but if I've sat through 45 minutes and the presentation's over, and I can't articulate in 3 sentences to my wife what the hook was, something went wrong.
Yeah, and that's their unique competitive advantage. Yeah. You know, when it comes to deals, and you're right. I think a lot of times folks just get so stuck in their box. In this case, it's, you know, presentations, that it's hard for them to move those things around. It almost feels uncomfortable. But you're right, when something is front and center and you know what those concerns are going to be, why would you not address those up front and thereby cast away the biggest doubt that investors would have up front? Because at that point, they'll probably be more on board to listen to whatever else you have to say.
Yeah. You know, my first sponsor is Lane Kawaoka, and he'll often, in a presentation, he'll have this chart, and it's kind of a continuum. And, you know, it'll have like risk and reward. It's like a risk and reward chart, or he'll even have one that's kind of like a 4-quadrant. And it's just to give the investor, like, what is this deal just visually? Like, is this the boring high, you know, yield play on an A-class asset? Is this the, you know, somewhere down on quadrant, this quadrant of you know, C market, heavy value add, but it's in a B neighborhood and we're going to bring it up. Where on the continuum of risk and reward are we? And, you know, he doesn't try to pitch every deal that everyone should buy. It's what works for you. And over the course of the year, he has a variety of different deals. And it's, you know, investors really should invest in what's good for them. You know, if you're an older couple and you just want your distributions, you know, that Class A property in Dallas that they bought in a good price and it's just a yield play, that could be a good deal. You know, a 40-year-old who's far off from retirement, who has a good income, finances are stable, you know, they might be much more excited about that, you know, C-class property in a B-class neighborhood in a hot market. And they don't care about distributions. They want to sell in 3 to 5 years and make a killing. You know, everything doesn't have to be a home run. One of the things that frustrates me is a lot of pitch decks try to be all to end all. Like they try to satisfy every constituent. And that's not realistic. If you want to go for the home run, go for the home run. Tell me that there's a lot of risks and how they're being mitigated. Maybe I don't invest with you. Maybe I do. But I wasn't going to invest with you one way or the other if I wasn't interested in a home run. You know, so tell the home, just if you're going to sell the home run, sell the home run. There's lots of investors out there that want the home run. And that way you're aligning the right people with the right capital and people with the right operator and right deal. To me, that's just, I get that capital's all of a sudden become hard to come by. People are scared. But I really think in the long run, it's better to get the right investors matched with the right deal.
Yeah. And I think that comes down to the sponsors really knowing their investors and, you know, potential investors, what their pain points are, and more importantly, what their goals are.
Yeah.
You know, if they're looking for cash flow for those distributions, then that deal that's a ground up or, you know, 100% reno probably isn't going to make sense for them because they're not going to see distributions till month 12 or 15, you know, but that might be a great fit for someone who's ready to just hand over their money and sit back for the long-term play for that big payout in the end. And that, yeah, so you're right. That really comes down to having those conversations and sponsors being open and honest and saying, you know, hey, Andrew, this deal probably doesn't make sense for you, but, you know, the next one that comes up, I'll definitely give you a call.
You know, Trevor Thompson, I've gotten to know the man. He's a great guy. He's, you know, pretty big influence on LinkedIn and on real estate. And yeah, he specifically told me when I met with him that he's had to just tell investors, you know, this isn't the right deal for you. You know, I got other ones I can send you or ones in the pipeline. Or, you know, even here's a friend of mine has a deal that matches you better. You know, he's about the most transparent, high ethically principled person I've met. And, you know, he's in it for the long run. And if he believes, you know, if I take care of investors, I'm going to get lots of referral work from them. Because when they tell their friends, hey, this guy told me this isn't the deal for me, but, you know, sent me to his friend's deal that matched me well, people are going to remember that. If I heard, you know, if someone told me that, my first thought was, I got to meet this guy. So I think if you're playing the long game and you do right by investors, I really believe that it's going to come back to you in the right way. You just got to play the long game. I mean, you're planning on being in business, you know, 5 years from now or 10 years from now. There's no need to chase the wrong capital. There's still enough capital out there.
Exactly. It's not a zero sum game. So while it's hard to get over that mindset, you know, from the sponsor perspective, we can't think of it as a competition against, you know, this guy or that guy for their deals, because we have different audiences, right? Like we have different people that we resonate with or that already know and trust us. So that fear of someone coming in and scooping away investors, it's not really founded, is what I've come to discover.
Yeah, I mean, once you're invested in more than one deal with the sponsor, you're pretty in bed with that sponsor. There's already a trust level. And frankly, there's a laziness factor. You know, I don't have another username and password. You know, you're going to the same website. You like the website. You've downloaded K1s before. You know, the sponsor sends out emails. You know, when there was a fire, he told you what was, you know, what happened and how they didn't turn out to be a big deal because they had the proper insurance. There's a level of trust that once a person's with you on more than one deal, the odds of somebody stealing them from a sponsor is pretty low. I mean, they may invest with other people just for diversification's sake, but it's going to be pretty hard to cockroach, to poach somebody who's already done more than one deal with a person if everything's been above board.
Yeah. And I think I've heard you say it a couple of times, transparency is a key to that, you know, developing that trust, because as we know, bad news doesn't get better with time. So when things happen, there cannot be silence, because silence is definitely in that, you know, it tells me that if I'm not getting an answer, there's something wrong.
Yes. Yeah. That's, you know, everybody's in the customer service business, you know, investors aren't going to call that often, but you know, when they have a question, if investor relations doesn't answer it in a timely fashion, I mean, it's no different than any other business. You know, there's a lot of good sponsors out there. I mean, you're not going to stick with somebody who doesn't, you know, it shows you how much they value you if they don't respond to you within a timely fashion.
Yeah. And I think it instills, you know, faith and confidence in the sponsor if they're upfront with you and like, hey, yesterday we had, you know, a flood in this unit in the child's room, which, you know, is something that happened to us, and the entire roof just caved in because of water. The ceiling caved in because of water. Luckily, the child wasn't in his crib at the time and nobody was hurt, but there was a ton of damage. Obviously, you know, the tenants were very upset, but you want to tell them like, hey, this happened, but here's what we did to deal with the situation. We immediately moved them into another unit. You know, we are already working to get them compensated for this, that, and the other. In this instance, we found out it was the fault of the city water, because they turned they turned on the wrong water because we were switching out meters and stuff. It was a mess. Either way, it's not very comforting to a tenant to say, well, it wasn't our fault, it was the city's fault.
Yeah.
Like that's at the moment that's largely irrelevant. You need to take care of that tenant because they're a customer as well, right? They're the customer on the other side. And so that's the most important thing. Yeah. So you just have to be prepared for that stuff that goes wrong, deal with it, but then communicate to your investors, not just what happened, but what you're doing to fix it. And then usually everyone's like, okay, sounds like you got it.
Yeah, that's all investor asks for, is just to be kept apprised. You know, people get that things happen. But people hate silence or being told after the fact, like you say.
Yeah, well, this has been great discussion, but I want to move on to the keys to success round. So I'm just going to ask you a few questions in pretty quick succession, and I'd like you to give me your thoughts on these. So what is one red flag every investor should look out for?
Okay, the one for me that's the most glaring but not common would be an exit cap rate that's lower than the entry cap rate. So what I mean is, if you're buying the building at a 4 cap, you know, you can't be selling it at a 3 cap. That's not realistic. All the good sponsors are going to bump it up so many basis points, you know, per year. And most are going to go anywhere from 75 to 100 basis points higher than what they bought it at. So if you bought it at, to me, I'd prefer if you bought it at a 4 cap, your pro forma should be selling it at a 5 cap. And it's nice if you have a spreadsheet with sensitivity analysis of, you know, at 4.75, at 4, you know, 4.5, at 4, whatever. I mean, we both know, Tim, if you want to play with an IRR, we can play with an IRR. But the most egregious is when you're messing with the exit cap rate.
Right. And that's just a matter of being conservative in your underwriting.
Yeah, if your exit cap rate's lower than the entry, I'm gone. We're not talking anymore. Don't email me any further. We're done.
Yeah, and you could think in your own head that you will have that lower cap rate. And the market may have signs that that's where it's headed, but none of us can look into our crystal ball 3 to 5 years from now. It's just, it's too far out to make assumptions that are that optimistic, I think, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Also, too, is it kind of lets you off the hook. If you're not using a higher cap rate, it's really telling me that, like, are you really adding the real value? You know, because you're saying you're going to do all these value add projects to raise rent. You know, just because the spreadsheet says you're going to raise rent by all these lovely percentage assumptions in an Excel spreadsheet, you know, now I got to ask myself, like, well, really? I mean, like, you sealed the driveway, you put up a new sign, like, you're going to raise rents $300? you know, I don't know. I'm a tenant. I'm like, okay, you sealed my driveway. There's a new sign. Like, I don't know. You're going to raise rent $300. Like, you know, I've seen the before and after pictures of the kitchens and it's like, okay, you know, like that's all lovely and good, but you know, the net income divided by the cap rate, that cap rate under the bottom is such a overwhelming driver of the end result of the valuation of a property that any fudging of that, and it's like, we can't really work together.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, what is a myth or assumption about this business you would like to set straight?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a myth, but I think it's a misnomer. I just had a LinkedIn post on it that, you know, I probably could have articulated better, but you know, the idea that there's anything in life that's passive is kind of the misnomer. Because, you know, people said, oh, Andy, you passively invest in real estate when you have a property manager. I'm like, no. You know, I got to read the statements. You got to follow up. You got to ask them questions. You know, they're still going to call you when the toilet's leaking or something. You're going to be involved. And even on the multifamily side, you're going to have to watch the presentation. Now, granted, if you've been with a sponsor and you've done multiple deals with the guy, okay, maybe you can just, you know, flip through the pitch deck. Okay, I get it. You've done this before. But there's a certain base level of knowledge of the lingo, the math. It's not, you know, rocket science, but it's a unique math of its own. You're going to want to, you know, learn from other investors, like, okay, what markets are there and why? You know, why should I not do a hot market or why should I do a hot market? That's not passive. You're going to have to get to a certain minimum level of knowledge if you're really going to do yourself the right to get a return. If you're just going to pick a guy because he has a cute podcast, he has a hot city, you know, all the stuff we talked about, the drone photo, and he's promising high RARs and you know, high cash on cashes, you're basically the same as the guys that invested in ARK in on the stock market world. I don't know if you know Kathy Woods. You know, her promising these absurd, you know, annualized returns. And anytime she has a down period, don't worry, we just buy the dip. It's just, you know, don't worry, it'll be fine. We're going to make 50% annualized returns. And then you go to her website and she'll actually have changed the time periods of the results that she shows on her website. So if a time period wasn't advantage, you know, looks bad for her, she just take it off the website. These are the kind of things that you get led into if you don't have enough knowledge. You know, the dumb retail money, some of it has left the stock market. A lot of dumb retail money was lost in the crypto markets. But any of that money that comes into the real estate space, my concern is they're going to follow the same mistaken pattern of chasing returns with no idea of the risk they're taking. You know, it's like yield. It's like in the bond world, yield chasing. When you're chasing yield so high that you'll go after a junk bond, even when the spread between junk and, you know, high quality has narrowed really significantly, but you're so desperate for yield, you're going to go buy this product that has an asymmetrically high level of risk. It's just, it's frustrating to me.
Yeah. And that certainly is a risk, especially for new people coming into the business. But your bottom line is spot on that, hey, you have to do the work at least upfront to educate yourself. And that's the case for any investment, right?
Yeah.
Not just real estate.
But, you know, like most people would spend more time picking a refrigerator than they are going to spend on picking an investment. It's just bizarre to me.
All right. And the last question, what does success look like to you?
You know, the most successful people I know, oddly enough, probably spend more time educating themselves than the unsuccessful investors. It really is quite interesting. You know, the capacity and willingness to want to constantly learn and to stay humble, that really is to me what success is about. When you're in a place, you know, fit, you know, health-wise, family, you know, career, wealth, or whatever, where what you're doing is fun, when you're making money, but it's fun to make money. That to me is when you've hit success.
Yeah, absolutely. Continuous learning. And I think it kind of sounds like lifestyle by design. I know that's a phrase that gets put out there, but you're living life that you want to live.
Yeah, I mean, oddly enough, a lot of the most successful people that I've met, they're not really into the whole FIRE thing. You know, this isn't, you know, financial independence, retire early and,
sure,
you know, go golfing 5 days a week and travel 9 months a year. I don't meet many people frankly, that that's worked for. I've met quite a few people that did it for 3 months, got bored out of their mind, and came back to work. You know, it is, work is a funny word. Is work is work if you don't like what you're doing or you're doing it for a paycheck. If you enjoy investing in apartment buildings, if you enjoy buying apartment buildings, or, you know, whatever it is within real estate, and you're making money and you're enjoying it, that's not work.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, I like the ability to do it on my own terms in times in terms of like the hours and things like that. You know, I have the freedom of time to make my own schedule, essentially.
Time is the most valuable currency. You know, the Federal Reserve can't print more of it.
Exactly. Well, Andrew, hey, this has been great. I really appreciated your unique perspective as a prolific passive investor. So please tell our guests how they can get a hold of you and if you have anything else you'd like to say.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, if you want to find me on LinkedIn, it's pretty easy to find me. Probably post too much on LinkedIn. But if you want content from a very opinionated person who's on the blunt side, that would be me. And then my email is pretty easy. It's just andrew@hawaiicourtreporters.com. My family runs a court reporting agency. My father's run it for 50 years. I've been with him the last 20. And I always love talking to investors. And anybody who has a question, I'm always happy to answer. And if I don't know the answer, I'll still read to people that do know the answer. I'm not going to fudge an answer to save my ego.
Awesome. Andrew, thanks again. We'll have all that information in the show notes. I really appreciate you coming on and providing all that insight.
Now, thanks for being a great host, Tim.
You've been listening to the Journey to Multifamily Millions podcast with host Tim Little. Be sure to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a review as well to help us reach more people like you. For more information on how you can start your journey to multifamily millions, visit ZonaInvestments.com. And remember, every journey starts with a single step, and there's always more to learn.